Gregoire and Dan Beeston are smart enough to know better.
Welcome to episode 162 of Smart Enough to Know Better.
We're a podcast of science,
comedy,
and ignorance.
I'm Dan Beeston.
I'm Gregoire.
And in this episode of Smart Enough to Know Better, I shall be howling at the moon.
And 47 is the saddest number that you'll ever do.
But before we get there, what happened to you this week in science?
This is one of those stories which I think the whole world may know about, I just didn't know about. So forgive me, listeners, but this is one of those I was this many years old when I discovered stories.
Ooh.
This is a real thing. I never really put two and two together when it comes to brushing my teeth and orange juice. Have you ever done that before?
It's not a good thing. It's not a pleasant experience.
Don't brush
your teeth with orange juice.
It's true. It's all that sugars get in there and it makes your teeth rot. The dentists will cry. But I don't really drink a lot of orange juice, and I don't drink a lot of orange juice around toothbrushing time. So these things haven't really come into my life a lot.
Wednesdays.
You just call them Wednesdays?
That's toothbrushing day.
Oh, God. You brush your one tooth whether it needs it or not?
Yeah. It always does.
Oh, God. It's how you keep yourself protected in these terrible times. You bite someone and then they're weakened by the toxins on your tooth, and then you follow them. And then you can take them down.
Like a Komodo dragon.
Like a Komodo dragon, yeah. Anyway, I noticed recently because, you know, for reasons we won't go into, all our lives are up in the air at the moment doing exciting things.
Mine's pretty standard.
Mine's different. And so I have started eating breakfast, and I'm going to stop it because it's really wrong. Stop eating breakfast, everyone. What's wrong with you people? God damn it.
But it's the third most important meal of the day.
It is. It's like another meal. I packed on so much weight because I was like, why am I packing on weight? Oh, that's because I'm added another meal to my life. I'm like a hobbit. Anyway, neither here nor there. So orange juice came back into my world and also around toothbrushing time in the morning. So mm-hmm. All cool. And so I was brushing my teeth, blah, 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 and then I took a big swig of orange juice and went, Jesus Christ, this orange juice is off. Good God, it's like super off. And I spat it out. Like, it was really scary. It was bitter as hell. And I was like, oh, my God, and I checked the expiry date. That seems to be fine. And I said, that's really weird. And I finished brushing my teeth, washed my mouth out. And then later on in the day, I went, let me just go check the orange juice again. Took a glass and went, that's fine. Hang on a minute. It's fine. Why is it? Hang on a minute. Something's up here.
I mean, you shouldn't be having a swig of orange juice just after you brushed your teeth because, like, orange juice is full of sugar and acid.
I know, Dan. As I said, my life is turned upside down at the moment. Don't you judge me.
I'm just, all right.
These are apocalypse rules now, baby. The fact that I am not on the doofmobile firing my flamethrower guitar at the world. It's a goddamn miracle. Not dressed up as Zardoz. I'm so desperate to dress up as Zardoz because I got a very similar body type to Sean Connery at that time.
You don't even have a car anymore. Like, you're just going to have to be off the front of your bicycle with a guitar shooting flames.
I'm going to tie a random stranger to the front of my bike as a prow and put a guarding implement on their face and then inject myself with their blood. This is actually a bad idea.
Yeah, anyway, you're going to stay 1.5 metres away from them, so they'll have to be out on a rod or something. And the wind's going to be blast. They're going to be exhaling, and their exhalation is going to be flooding over you as you ride. You haven't thought this out at all. This is like the orange juice thing all over again.
How dare you, sir? I will, of course, always ride downstream, like with the wind. So the wind is blasting faster than I can ride, and it'll blast it away from me. I've thought this through.
I don't know whether you have.
I will run, not tack. I will run with the wind as a sailor. As my father, my father, who doesn't listen to this podcast, he'll be very, very, as a sailor, he'll be very excited that I knew the term run. I'm going to run with the wind, not run with my legs, like run. It doesn't matter. The point of this, was it orange juice? That's what we were talking about, wasn't it? Orange
juice.
So the next day I went back. Had forgot about it. I just thought it was weird that the orange juice was fine. Did it again, Dan. And guess what? Orange juice was, of course,
awful.
Bitter. And I went, right. Once is happenstance. Twice is coincidence. Three times is enemy action. James Bond rules. That's my science James Bond rules. And so I did
so
it
that
again.
Would be,
and
so that would be double OJ. Da-da-da-da-da.
That's very good. So I did an experiment where I took toothpaste, I just put it in my mouth, I took a big swig of orange juice, I went, oh my god, okay, this is it, I've worked it out now. It's something to do with the two. Of course, I went and checked the internet. The internet's like, yes, of course, you moron. This is a thing that 4-year-olds know.
Oh, yeah.
What? Not 40-somethings. Like, what are you doing? But I looked into the science of it, and I'm really, really interested. Do you know how it works? Do you know why it happens?
Ooh. Oh, no, this is interesting. Well, orange juice is acidic, so is toothpaste, like, really alkaline or something? And there's some sort of and it's desensitizing the tongue or what? No, I don't.
You've got the last bit is correct. It's desensitizing the tongue in some way, but no, the rest of it's wrong. But I would never have known this either. So I'll just tell you what it is. It's something in the toothpaste called sodium lauryl sulfate, SLS, and it's surfactant. So it's a sudser. It's what makes it sudsy. Gives it that sudsiness. And it creates a froth on the toothpaste, and basically you put it all over your mouth, and it lowers the surface tension of the saliva in your mouth and allows bubbles to form. That's how you get the bubbles in your mouth.
Okay, yeah. But wouldn't that be raising because now there's bubbles forming?
No, it's lowering the surface tension of the saliva in your mouth.
Oh, yes.
And, like, and therefore soap. The bubbles can now form.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly right. Yes. And one thing, so you get the frothiness. What it also does, it suppresses, they think anyway, suppresses the sweet receptors on your tongue. So it gets in there and goes, no, sweet receptors, you can't activate now. So your body's like, I can't taste sweet. So you can't taste the sweet overtones of the orange juice. But it's not just then. That's not the end of it. SLSs, as we've learned from a lot of hand washing recently, a point of soap is it destroys fatty buildup. It has a water-loving molecule, part of the molecule, and water-hating molecule.
Yep.
And it can tear apart the outside of viruses if they're covered in a fatty sheath. So there is things called phospholipids on your tongue, these fatty deposits on your tongue. And they actually, these fatty deposits get in your tongue and normally stop the bitter receptors on your tongue from activating as often. So normally you're protected against bitter. This sodium lauryl sulfate is decreasing your ability to taste sweet and increasing your ability to taste bitter. And suddenly you put a sweet and bitter thing in your mouth. You can't taste the sweet anymore. And the bitter is thrown through the roof and you get horrible tasting orange juice.
Hey, huzzah.
We think. That's what scientists, no one actually knows. That's just the latest theory, by the way.
So if you want to drink orange juice after you brush your teeth, you should firstly have a bite of some cold lamb or something and cover your tongue again with lipids.
That's a really good question. Yes, I guess so. Yeah, fatty deposits. And maybe that's why you do enjoy – I mean, there's umami taste in the tongue. We could talk about tongues. I think we have in the past. But umami and different tastes in the tongue. But maybe that's it. Maybe covering your tongue in fat does suppress bitterness and the things taste sweeter and nicer. That could be true, actually. I think you may have hit something on the head there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a story for another time when I'm brushing my teeth with meat, obviously.
Look, I expect it to happen before next podcast. Your life is upside down.
That sounds like the sexiest thing I'll ever do.
I get it.
Just leave it there, Dave. That wasn't.
Shall we move on?
I think I got away. I think the audience will pick up on the subtle commentary I just made there. Help me.
Oh,
how was your week of science, Dan?
I made some pizza dough.
Nice. That's everyone. So you're the one who's taking all the bloody flour, monster.
Oh, I went to the Asian grocery store, and they got these giant sacks of flour with strange names, and I'm like, and I'm like, yoink! It all comes from wheat. It's all tiny and white. It'll do. So yeah, I got flour, but I didn't take it from Woolies. I found a place where they had heaps of flour. No yeast.
No yeast. Oh, no.
Yeah. Now the yeast is interesting because I've been making my own pizza dough for a while and I'd been buying like a little pack of yeast and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to buy a big tin of yeast. I did that a couple of years ago, got a big tin of yeast and I went and I put this big tin of yeast in the freezer and there was a twin sitting next to it. And I'm like, where did this big tin of yeast come from? And the Frog Princess was like, I bought a big tin of yeast. And I was like, we have enough yeast here for 6 years. Unfortunately, it goes off sooner than that. So I pulled out. So when I wanted to do some baking just recently, I opened them up and both of them expired like 3 years ago.
Oh, okay. Yep.
But they don't expire by going off. They just aren't as active. And so I did a little experiment and they are fine. They do their yeasty thing. So it's that's lucky.
Best by date, not a use by date.
Yeah. So we got heaps of yeast. It's brilliant.
Nice. So in the Smart Enough to Better comedy bunker, you're down for dough, basically. You're
fine. The bread man.
Oh, that's such a cool name for the apocalypse. Go see the bread man, the gluten king.
Yeah. The gluten king. Oh, I like that. So I've been making some pizza dough, and that involves some flour and salt and sugar and some yeast.
Sugar?
Yeah, a little bit of sugar so that the yeast has something to eat.
Ah, of course. So it's not for taste. It's for keeping the yeast alive. And
yeah. So usually I put it in and after 2 hours I make pizza. But I was following a recipe by Kenji Lopez Alt, who we cooked a Xenomorph with once.
Absolutely. We certainly did.
and so you put this dough in the fridge for between 1 and 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And the yeast keeps eating. Now, usually with dough, you need to knead it and knead it and knead it so it's all homogenous. But this is the no-knead pizza dough. So you give it a little bit of a knead, but it's sort of this lumpy mess. But because you leave it for a day, the yeast actually grows and eats sugar and puts out carbon dioxide and makes little air bubbles in it. And this mechanism, all the way through, actually self-kneads the dough on a molecular level.
So, oh, wow.
So you don't have to push it and pull it because the yeast is doing all the work for you. And I thought that was brilliant. So that's the self-kneading dough. And so when you pull it out of the fridge after a day, it's like real nice and homogenous and smooth. So saith the gluten king.
Pizzas for all! When we were children, life was really fun and exciting, and you're like, adventures. And you go, oh, one day I'm going to get older, I'm going to get a job, I'm going to meet someone, we're going to go traveling, and it's going to be really great. Like, you know, life was great.
No. I hated being a kid. I love being a grown up.
Did you really
love it?
Well, there you go. Well, a lot of people like enjoyed their childhood, and as they get older, they start going, oh, is this it? Like, is this? And like they hit their 20s and they're like, oh, cool. Now I'm in my mid-20s. Is this it? Is this what I'm doing? Is this what I'm doing for the rest of my life? And everyone's like trying to reinvent themselves and find their next thing and settle. Maybe it's settling down. Oh, no, I'll push out a couple of kids or I'll learn to ride a Ferrari or I'll whittle a gun or something. Like whatever adults do. And I'll drink all the beer. I'll drink all the beer in the world, and I'll just drink it. And like, they keep finding.
Can you hear that?
Oh, it's Mr. Whippy.
That's Mr. Whippy.
Nice.
Have you noticed that the Mr. Whippy song goes at like 4 times the speed it used to? When I was a kid, it would like play Greensleeves of like ding 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 ding. Ding, 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 ding. Now Mr. Whippy sounds like he's doing burnouts or fish tails.
And I like the idea that some, and then they become an adult, will be listening to. They'll go to a concert and they'll go, and now Greensleeves. I go, God, this is slow. It's so slow. It's such na 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 na. Na. Like and all the millennials just go to sleep.
Yeah, I listened to some tutorials and I like coding tutorials and I speed them up to like 1.25 speed and occasionally it goes back to one if I like delete my cookies or something and I'm like, why did this guy record drunk this week or something? Oh no, I'm used to him speaking faster.
I do that too. I want to watch play Hearthstone, so I went to play and I how to play the game properly sort of thing. And there's some people just take they just you're like yes get on with it. You're spreading it out to 10 minutes. I've got 10 minutes to watch this. Mm. I've got like 5 minutes. So I speed it up and you get all the information. You're fine. Yeah. They sort of say do this and then do that. Like oh for God's sake, just and yeah, same thing. When you slow it down, they're like oh my God, they've had a brain injury. It's terrible.
There's that thing recently on the internet with the number 2 from Star Trek. He would introduce Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Oh, Jonathan Frakes.
And someone slowed that down, and it sounds like someone's drunk uncle. So it's just this straight. Initially, it was just all these questions. spliced together so he sounded like a mad old uncle. And then someone slowed it down and now he sounds drunk and is like, have you ever been in a bicycle race? What's the first time you learned about how the sky... And it's just, it's brilliant.
I have to look it up. That's great. Hey, where were we? Where were we? Hang on. Drinking all the beer. That's right.
Drinking all the beer.
That's right. Drinking all the beer. And so sometimes it feels that things are not as good. And as you get older, I hate to say it, this feeling grows. Like you start going, and people go through midlife crises, especially men. Like, but I think everyone does it, but not everyone, but both genders do it. And everyone in between, everyone does it. The best chance where they kind of worry about, is this it? And you talk to some people who are older and they talk about being more miserable. And there was like, I've noticed this too. People go, oh, I'm not as, you know, things hurt more or that didn't work for me. They have more sad stories than happy stories. It's very sad. But then I was thinking about older people, and some older people are really sad, but a lot of older people are, oh, everything's great. We don't care. We're going to go outside and do cool things. And, you know, and you're like, oh, it's interesting. I noticed a trend in my life of super old people are like, yeah. And also because death is coming, you have no time to be sad. And but everyone else is kind of like, oh, you know, you've got, if you're in your 30s, you've got like 30 more years of, you know, working for the man to earn a crust, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And so I did a look into this. Is this just my weird feeling or is this something that's real? And I found a very recent article about this, about peak misery.
Peak misery?
Peak misery. And I've kind of given it away at the start of the show, by the way, when I sang my little song. So, you know, you already know the answer. But let's all get there together. It seems that when a Dartmouth College professor, David Blanchflower, did a study across 132 countries measuring the relationship between well-being and happiness and age, he took into account whether or not they were rich countries or poor countries, mm-hmm. and whether they lived longer or they didn't live longer as well. So he tried to get rid of these variables. So it wasn't just about rich people or first world nations where you might live longer.
Mm-hmm.
And what he discovered is that self-reported unhappiness increases your entire life. So people in their 20s report themselves to be at a level of happiness, but those same people in their 30s say they're more unhappy, and then they get to their 40s and they're more unhappy.
Wow.
Keeps going up and up and up. They're always more unhappy on average. You know, these are course curves.
Yeah.
You trend as you get older, you get more and more unhappy, and then you reach peak unhappiness. And where do you think that is, Dan?
Somewhere between the ages of 45 and 49?
47.2. There you go. So when you reach 47.2, you're at your peak miserable. That will be your most unhappy, you're unlikely to be in your entire life. Self-reported unhappiness.
That's something to look forward to. Like after that, it's
yeah.
It's the only way is up.
I'm 45, and so I looked at that, and it made me happy. Because I went, even if I am unhappy now.
Yeah.
I've only got 2 more years.
Only 2 more years.
Yes.
And look, frankly, it's not like the people who would usually be really happy at this age are going to be like having the best year this year.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I'm allowed to be a bit unhappy this year. But it made me happy. So I was trying to work out, do you think that this paper has now going to, if you've read the paper, it's going to change your view on unhappiness? Because someone in their 40s who knows unhappiness is about to end relatively soon.
Yeah.
Will become happier. They will skew the data.
Data then going to start skewing more and more backwards until the most miserable people in the world are children?
Are children, as it should be. But yes, there's an unhappiness
If I'm ever as miserable as I was when I was 11 years old, just send me the makings for a suicide bag.
I remember very clearly I was 10 or 11 and I was sitting on the bottom of the stairs, crying my eyes out in the morning, like 6 in the morning.
No.
And I was bawling. Like
having a little wah.
Yeah, having a little wah. And I was crying, like not bawling, I guess, just sobbing and quietly. So, and then my dad was like, what's up with you? And I very clearly went, I don't know. I'm just sad. And my father just looked at me and sat next to me and patted me on the shoulder in a way a baby boomer from the 40s can.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do right now. You there, strange child. Look, he loved me very dearly. He does.
Joyce, he's having an emotion.
Yeah, that's right. I don't. Do I beat him?
Is there a powder?
Surely I can beat this emotion out of him.
An oil or something?
An unction. Bring me an unction for the boy.
Get the unction.
So if you're feeling a bit down, hold on at least to 47.2. And then things are going to get better. Things can only get better.
Or order a smart enough no better salve. That's right. The smart enough no better happiness salve. Apply it to yourself to make all your concerns float away. Some itching is expected.
Ignore the fact that it'll make your orange juice taste bitter. That's a total coincidence. Don't read the bottle.
Gregoire, it is time to moon some astronauts.
Sasquatch or Bigfoot, who is who? It's all going down at the Cryptozoo.
Alana contacted us with this question.
Mm.
She said, the flight of Apollo 11, if Mike Collins is a werewolf, at what point during translunar injection does he go furry? And how many times during the mission profile is he forced to shapeshift by the light of the full moon?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a hard one. This is I did see that one on Twitter. Thank you, Alana. And I have been percolating it through my head, having a think about it. And there are a lot of variables here.
Yeah.
A lot of variables.
So the Apollo program was NASA's program to send humans to Olympus to meet Apollo, the god of poetry. Each time they failed and ended up closer and closer to the Earth's moon, which we have named Colin, until they accidentally landed on it several times.
I hate you so much.
Now, werewolves. We've previously looked into werewolves and the effect of silver of them in episode 39.
Ooh.
They turn from a man into a wolf man on the night of the full moon.
Yes, yes.
No woman can turn into a werewolf.
Because it's a werewolf, it's a man wolf.
Yes, a werewolf.
Yes.
A were means male. Traditionally, mankind was everyone. Mm-hmm. A were man was a male human, and a woe man was a female human. So a lady who transforms would be a werewolf.
Werewolf?
Werewolves and werewolves.
Okay, werewolves and werewolves. Okay, got it. Got it. Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, Pussycat? Whoa, 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 wolf.
Well, you can't have pussycats and wolves together. That's
God damn it.
That's a mistake.
God, he's an idiot. That Welsh singer I can't remember the name of. Damn it.
Tom Jones.
Yeah, Tom Jones is a bloody idiot. You tell him he's the worst cryptid investigator I've ever heard of.
You tell him. He's kick scary. My ass.
I know. I've seen him. He's like 90 years old and like, no, I'm not going anywhere near him.
Okay, so the first question to ask
probably
is...
Probably many STDs. Like, think about the STDs he probably has or had. You know, he had a lot of ladies like him and men. Basically, everyone loved Tom Jones.
Oh, yeah.
Underwear. I don't mean he had sex with dirty people, just underwear thrown at him.
Well, that's not hygienic.
That's not hygienic. Stop doing that, everyone.
Unless it's to smart enough. Smartenough.org.
Salve.
Postbox 4152.
No! Don't send your underwear. Oh, God. No. Oh, that's like a biological weapon. You get done for terrorism charges.
Yeah. So the first question to ask is, was the moon full on approach?
Well, no. I think we have to... You're jumping far too quickly into spaceships approaching moons. Yeah, I think we have to get back on that, because we have to start thinking, when does a werewolf change? So on the full moon, the werewolf changes. But I'm going to base this on movies I've seen, because that's only data. Werewolves don't just say it's full moon and then transform when the moon rises. I've seen movies where they're inside and someone throws open a window and they, the full moon! And they transform.
Yeah.
Or the clouds part. So the full moon's well in the sky and the clouds part and they, the full moon! So a couple of choices here. It either has to be the brightness of the moon, has to be a certain level of light has to hit them.
Yep.
And therefore that triggers the transformation physically.
Yep.
Or it's psychosomatic, and when they see the full moon, their brain goes, that's a full moon, I better transform into a werewolf. So I'm just trying to work this out. If they go into space and Michael Collins is in space looking at the moon, when they went into space, they couldn't see – they'd navigate by the stars. So they actually would actually, they could see the stars and they could see the sun and they could see the moon and they could see the earth.
Oh, okay. Yep. Yep.
Because they had to know where they were in space.
That's hard to work. Like, the only way to do that is to find a star that you know where it is and find a moon where you know where it is and just where the earth is.
Three points in space, basically, and including the Earth at this point.
I mean, not stars, though. Like, if you had 3 points in space and they were stars, you'd want to know how big the moon was behind you. And, like, you'd want the closest things to be good. The closest things would be better waypoints than the furthest things away. Because you wouldn't be able to judge where you were based on three stars because they would always be the same distance away, kind of.
No, but you know exactly where you're pointing at that point.
And you
will know where the moon is because you would have done the math before you left.
Yes. Well, but if something went wrong.
Oh, which Apollo 13 did.
Yeah. Or even Apollo 11, the lander came down too fast. It was going too fast when it was approaching the moon and their landing spot was off by kilometers.
Yeah, but that was because Neil Armstrong was looking for a place to land that wasn't as rocky. That wasn't a computer error or any of that. They were actually like, we need to – he wanted a flat place because he's worried that he'd hit a boulder and tip over.
He definitely did that, but they also just realized when they were coming down that certain elements on the moon were appearing faster than they expected them to and were going, oh, we're going too fast. And that's why they'd planned to land on a nice flat bit, but they overshot the flat bit. And then there was a rocky bit, and he had to do some clever stuff to avoid landing on rocky bits.
Okay. I'll bow to your take on that. I don't know how true that is. I'm sorry.
Well, luckily, we've got the Walk of Shame. So
Listeners can figure out who's right. Everyone should go and listen to 13 Minutes to the Moon, an amazing podcast, the Apollo 11 Man. In fact, they're doing Apollo 13 now, which is why I'm really into it. Anyway, neither here nor there. It doesn't matter. So if it's light hitting them, so when Michael Collins, as soon as he went into space, he may be in a lot of trouble because the moon would look full.
Because it would be a lot brighter.
It would look a lot brighter, it would look full, that's right. And as he went around, has to be a full moon, it would have to be, as they went round the back of it and on a free return trajectory, which is like Apollo 13, it would go, it wouldn't be full. Sometimes it would look full and sometimes it wouldn't. But it would only look full when they were between the Earth and the moon.
He means the Earth and the sun.
Which it did. They did cross in front. They did actually go between the two. So, but I don't know enough, unfortunately. Did they go when it was full from the position of the Earth?
They did not go when it was full.
Excellent.
We know for sure that that was the case. Landing on the moon is tricky. You probably want to land where you've got lots of communication with Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of want to land in the center of the moon from Earth's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you want to land at a place just after the lunar dawn. So just after the sun has risen on the moon. They needed to land...
At that part of the moon.
Yes.
Yes.
So the center of the moon went just after dawn.
Right.
So they needed to land when the sun's elevation was between 5 degrees and 14 degrees.
Mm.
Now, when I say the sun, I mean the Earth's sun.
Yes, yes. You mean Chad.
That's the one? Yes. Okay, if the sun's elevation is lower than 4 degrees, the shadows are too long.
Mm-hmm.
The grey regolith is very brightly lit and drowns out anything dim to your eye. And there's almost no scattered light because there's no atmosphere. So the shadows are pitch black. So imagine you're trying to land in a long shadow, which you think is flat ground, and it turns out to be a great big rock that you just can't see because it's in shadow.
Yeah, you don't want that.
No. If the sun is higher than 14 degrees, there's too much light and you can't see the lumps on the ground. Everything gets sort of blown out. Because the moon, bloody bright.
Yeah, it is. It's super bright, yeah. Well, the moon itself...
When there's nothing else around.
And, well, even the moon itself is quite a dark object, but it's so much light hits it. It's not a big white marble thing in the sky. It's quite a dark grey.
It's like Bitumen Road.
Yeah, it's. I've been told it's almost coal-like. Yeah,
but very, very dark. Behind it, very, very black indeed.
Yeah, yes, and also bright, bright light, unfiltered sunlight.
Yeah.
Chad light.
Now, it's easier to land and deal with stuff in the lunar morning because it's not too hot. It's only just started receiving Chad's heat.
Mm-hmm.
But if they did it in the afternoon, the place would have been in full sunlight for 14 Earth days.
Yes. Yeah. A long time. Yeah.
Okay. That's... So The spaceship launches eastwards off the planet because it can, because otherwise you're fighting the rotation of the Earth.
It's rotating. Get a kick.
Get a kick. Because the Earth's rotating at like 1,000 kilometers.
I think it's 1,600 at the equator. I think roughly in that area. So if you're close to the equator, you're getting a free 1,600 kilometer an hour boost.
Yeah. And because if you went off the other, if you went the other direction, that'd be, you'd have to go 3,000 K faster.
Yes, to get away from, to escape the Earth. Yeah.
And I think I've heard that it's really hard to launch rockets from the poles.
Yeah, polar launches. Basically, it's, you've got no extra kick either way. So
yeah,
you just get, yeah.
So it's a that problem. so that one about the iron skies. Like, that Nazi technology must have been amazing.
That's right. They used argon energy. It's a whole different thing.
Ah, right. Okay, so they launch eastward. You get a boost. They steered for the left-hand side of the moon, and they went into orbit westwards on the moon. So right. They're going the opposite direction around the moon as they would orbiting around the Earth. They orbited the moon laterally. They didn't go top to bottom. Mm. If they'd orbited over the poles, they would never have been in front of the full moon.
Right, okay.
They orbited 30 times before descent, so that's 31 times in front of the full moon.
Ooh.
The lunar module descends, Collins spends another 3 orbits before they return, and they can't just go straight from above back to Earth. They've got to sort of whip out of lunar orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to go around at least one more time.
Right.
So I think, I can't find any more info about whether they were in orbit for longer after the thing.
Right.
But that adds up to 35 times that Collins was directly in front of the full moon.
For how long was he, like, how long would it take him to orbit around the moon, though? Did you look that up?
They were on the surface of the moon for about 6 hours. So I'm guessing about 2 hours to orbit the moon.
Okay, so he wouldn't be in front of the full moon for very long then. He would only be minutes at a time. He would be in transformation mode.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Then he would transform back. Okay, cool. So he wouldn't be there for a night, obviously. He would be there for a couple of minutes, and then he'd transfer back, and then he would...
He was very close to it.
Yes.
So it would be very big when he was looking at it, I imagine.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. It would. I mean, it would, yeah, it's, he was only a couple hundred kilometers into the air. Like, the air.
The empty space.
Don't you dare, Michael. Don't you dare. Stop writing.
A couple of hundred kilometers into the ether.
Yeah, that's right. Into the space.
The stellar void.
The phylostogen, Dan. It's full of phylostogen.
That's the stuff I was trying to think of. Okay, so 35 times in front of the full moon.
God. Before people get angry about that, it's not phylostogen. Phylostogen is what they thought was outside of the blank tarpaulin, the black tarpaulin that was up. Phylostogen was the fire that you could see pinpricking through it.
Oh,
the stars.
I see.
So phylostogen. So it was ether. It was the ether that we were all swimming through.
It's invisible.
The Michael Morley experiment, yes, that stuff, and phylostogen was the fire of the gods on the outside of reality, shining through the pinpricks of the bedsheet of reality or something. So don't write that either.
Again, a podcast of science, but also comedy and ignorance, which
so
I think is
ignorance.
Yeah, I think that lands. I think we landed that.
We got it.
So he would have turned into a wolfman 35 times.
Wow, I'd be exhausted.
Maybe. Because as you point out, is the change based on being in front of the full moon or is it the amount of moonlight?
Yes. Yeah.
Now,
location.
The average albedo of the full moon is -12.7, resulting in 0.1 lux.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay. 1 lux is 1 lumen per square meter.
Mm-hmm.
And a lumen is the total luminous flux emitted into a solid angle of 1 steradian by 1 candela of luminous intensity. A candela, you'll be interested to know, is defined by taking the fixed numerical value of the luminous efficiency of monochromatic radiation of frequency 540 times 10 to the 12th hertz KCD to be 683 when expressed in the unit LMW to the negative 1, which is equal to CDSRW negative 1 or CDSR kilograms negative 1 meters per negative 2 squared cubed, where the kilogram, meter, and second are defined in terms of HC and delta VCS.
Excellent.
Or one common candle.
One common candle. I was going to say, it's a candle. It's just a candle.
The albedo can fluctuate quite dramatically between a supermoon and a micromoon, up to 30% brightness.
Ooh, there you go.
So a wolf turn event will happen every full moon, even a micromoon.
Right, yes, it will. Okay. I like the idea that the werewolf just transforms. He's just smaller, though. He's like, wah!
He's tiny. Little teeny one.
Oh, you're a little werewolf. Wah, wah! Wah, 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 wah. It's like Ewoks. So maybe, Endor, when it's on a micromoon, you're fighting Ewoks. But when it's a major moon, you're fighting Wookiees.
He's a werepuppy.
Yes. Like Chewbacca is actually just a were-Ewok. A werewalk.
Now, the difference between...
Thank you for ignoring that. I appreciate
just going to move on. The difference between a full moon and the night prior to a full moon is only 10%. This means that the night before a supermoon can be brighter than the night of a micromoon.
Oh.
But the turn doesn't happen that on the night prior to a supermoon. It only happens on a full moon.
So it can't be brightness.
So it can't be brightness. Yes, now, obviously, if he's getting closer and closer to a half moon, there's going to the whole thing's going to be heaps of moonlight, but that's not going to affect him. It's only going to be when he's between Chad and Colin, the Earth sun and the Earth moon.
And so it's psychosomatic then. So it's not the amount of light hitting him. We've proven that now because the micromoon would set him off otherwise. It has to be in his brain. So when he sees the great big round moon, it's the shape of it that makes him go, oh, time to go.
Well, maybe there's something special about full moonlight. We've discussed this in the past. Imagine a surface that's covered in toilet rolls standing on their end.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine lots and lots of toilet rolls, I know, these days. But but if the light is behind you and the toilet rolls are at a slight angle, you don't actually see the surface at the bottom of the toilet rolls. But when they line up, you see the surface at the bottom of the toilet rolls, and the whole thing would be much more illuminated. Now, because there's no atmosphere on the moon and there's no way to scatter light, this is how light reflects from the moon's dusty surface.
Right, okay.
Yep. When the sun, during a full moon, there are almost no shadows at all, and those shadows actually take out a lot of the brightness of the moon. So there is something a bit different about a full moonlight to the night before or after.
Yeah, I guess. Maybe.
Maybe.
You know, maybe.
But the thing is, moonlight is just sunlight that's being reflected.
Yeah.
But that's kind of downplaying the effects of certain wavelengths being subtracted from light. If you were left in a red room for hours, it would affect your mental state.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
So this is all light theory and colour theory.
It doesn't fit that well, yeah. Yeah, okay. All right.
And about how fast food restaurants prefer to have lots of red and yellow because it makes people want to eat and leave.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and like music makes people, faster music makes you buy more, that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And then there's also the stuff about cool light waking you up and red light making you get more sleepy. Although I do have a note in my notes because someone said to me that that's not true and that's been disproven. And I haven't looked into it yet, but that might be another podcast.
Well, remember when we talked to the optometrist, Ben, and he came on the podcast and talked about optometry?
Yes.
He's my optometrist, and when I got my reading glasses, he said, hey, do you want this special coating that cuts out blue light so when you're looking at your iPad at night, it won't affect you as much? And I said, is it real or is it just snake oil? And he went, don't know. The jury is very much out on that one. And I went, oh, thank you for being honest. And he went, it's not going to cost you much more at all, like a couple of bucks extra. So look, it won't hurt to put it on, but I can't honestly say it will make your life better. And I was like, sure. So yeah, even optometrists are like, well, even that optometrist was like, we'll see. There's not enough evidence, I think.
Yeah. But perhaps there is something about certain amounts of those particular wavelengths of light from the moon that are affecting werewolves. There are a lot of animals on Earth that have lunar-induced behaviours. Cheetahs hunt during the full moon.
Mm-hmm.
Their vision isn't good enough to hunt by starlight.
Mm-hmm.
Grizzly bears hunt fish, but they use scent and touch because they don't have good vision under moonlight. And the salmon that they hunt also have terrible night vision.
Great.
Badgers prefer to mate during the full moon when the darkness allows them more protection from predators.
Like humans. Wait, hang on. So saying, though, I mean, you're talking about animals, and I mean, because we're all, most of us are probably city slickers, but if you go out in the dark when there's a full moon, like proper dark, like, you know, you go out into the country, you go into the outback, the moon is a massive difference. I mean, yeah. As in, if you have full moon means I can walk around, I can run around in the dark and see perfectly. I have no problems with running. I mean, in a forest, okay, you still have problems because the moon's not reaching you, but if you're just on a plane, like a not a plane, but, you know, like the where the rains in Spain mainly
fall. Yeah, I was using context clues to help me get arrive at that. Yeah,
cool. That's good. Then I can move through with my work. I've been out in the bush and had no problems on the darkest night with a full moon, easily moving around, like no problem whatsoever.
By definition, the darkest night is the absolute opposite to the one with the full moon.
Yes, yeah, exactly right. But then again, on the actual darkest nights, good Lord, you're in trouble. It's black, like everything's black. Though I will say, if you go into the Australian outback, deep into the outback, there's still a light there because you get what's called the zodiacal glow. Like the sky glows and you can still get this weird ghostly after images of the world around you. You wouldn't want to go running through it, but you can walk around and you can still see once your eyes get ready for it and get used to it. But the zodiacal glow is really interesting in the sky. So there's even light there. It's quite scary. It's not scary. It's quite weird. And when I first saw it, I couldn't work out what I was looking at. I thought I'd gone mad because you're like, there should be no light here, but I can see, do I have a superpower? Like maybe I'm like echolocating right now or something like that. But no, it's just so.
I mean, some animals do still hunt by starlight.
Yes.
Lions have very good eyes and are happy to hunt in the real darkness. And in fact, because full moons are so bright, they actually have less success at hunting because their prey can see them coming better. Yeah. And then on the flip side, humans tend to be attacked by lions more on the full moon. Because the lions will usually hunt the next day because they couldn't catch anything during the night. Or they will go after the humans because humans are more active on full moons because they can see stuff.
That's right. Yes, we are diurnal. We should not be out in the nighttime. We are not built for it at all.
Now, coral off the coast of Australia spawns on the full moon each December. This synchronizes the spawning event so that there's safety in numbers.
It's so gross.
Super gross. I love it.
I used to live in North Queensland and used to sail little sabots, so 2-meter masted vessels, as a child. And it was the worst thing in the world. After coral spawning, you'd have to go out and sail, and you're just going through this orangey, browny, reddy muck, and it stank, and it's rotting. It's all horrible, and it's the worst. And if you capsize and you have to get your, and you're swimming in this gunk, and
it's sea wank.
You are absolutely, yes. Good times.
Now, most of this behavior seems to relate more to a bright light source while it's nighttime, mm-hmm. and possibly related to their circadian rhythm, or to possibly tidal effects. The tides caused by the moon change the behavior of sea creatures quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the moon's effect has been documented as causing mental disturbance in humans. A study showed that schizophrenic patients had a slight rise in violent behaviour on the full moon, though the research group made a point that it may not have been exposure to the moon that caused this.
Mm.
But a similar study on non-schizophrenics showed no change occurred.
Yeah, and we've talked about this before in the podcast. People say, it's a full moon tonight, the police are going to be in trouble. No. There's going to be more people going to the hospital. No. It's just you remembering it wrong.
Yeah.
Or it's not true. So, yeah, the full moon doesn't drive most people to bad behavior or worse behavior.
There are hospital people, there are nurses and doctors and ER staff and police officers who are shouting at us right now because they are absolutely sure that the full moon causes crazy behavior. But these people are probably suffering what's called cognitive bias.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. It's over, been shown over and over again. It absolutely does not. People are just dicks all the time.
but a bright moon can cause sleep disturbances in light sleepers, causing mood problems.
Mm.
And light-sensitive epileptics can be slightly more at risk on the night of a full moon.
Right.
Because during the day, everything's bright. But at night, they can see like this one really bright thing and everything else is dark. And that can actually affect an epileptic.
Right. So was Michael Collins an epileptic werewolf?
Well, here's another thing to consider, Gregoire.
Yes,
werewolves are on a strict 29-and-a-half-day rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
They grow extra hair. They become emotionally volatile. They crave comfort food, and it happens once a month and involves quite a lot of blood.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar, Gregoire?
Not at all, Dan. I'm not walking into this trap. I refuse.
Human menstruation.
I'm not. No.
I reckon werewolves have an approximate 29-day hormonal cycle that can be activated by a light-sensitive epilepsy combined with a circadian rhythm that only activates at nighttime. If werewolfism is a hormonal condition, Michael Collins and his crew would not have been at risk because he would have used up his hormones 6 or 7 days prior to launch.
Oh,
so
okay.
I don't think that he would have transformed into a werewolf at all on the trip.
Right.
And everyone else was safe within the parameters of being safe whilst trying, whilst on the end of an exploding machine and trying to land on something with no air.
That's right, using nothing but one rocket and eyeballing it. You have to remember they didn't have powerful computers back then. Insane. Insane. How they made, I don't know. And they did multiple times. Good Lord. They shouldn't hire werewolves.
They should hire vampires.
Well, it'd be easy to pack their food. They had their food in tubes anyway. That's fine.
Yeah.
Maybe ghosts? Mummies?
Ghosts would skip the middleman, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you skip. They died. Yeah, we know. We killed them before they came. Oh, that's right. It's fine then. They're ghosts. Yeah, we should have. Mummies. What else can survive?
Space. I mean, mummies can't survive like any sort of explosive event. Like, they catch fire.
Oh, the Shape of Water, the creature in the Black Lagoon, it's already holding its breath for long periods of time. So maybe it could hold its, like, if something went wrong, it could, like, go and, like, hold its breath and, like, get into the other side.
Very dry in space, though. He'd dry out really quickly.
Yeah, it's true. And you don't want to lift a lot of water up.
Send ghosts, you could just get those three astronauts who died in the fire and just, because they've already trained, so you get their ghosts to pilot the ship.
Ow. Okay. Yes. Yeah, we could do that.
One small step for ghost, one giant leap for ghost kind. Welcome to the Walk of Shame. In each episode of Smart Enough to Know Better, Greg and I surreptitiously inject falsities into the narrative that allow our audience pretend to be a part of the narrative.
We're training you up to find the fake falsehoods we didn't mean to say. We meant to say, damn it.
So this one does not seem fair, Gregoire.
Why is that?
In the online party that you organized on Zoom...
You mean that very nice thing that I organized?
Nice casual chat.
Our listeners to come together and celebrate our listenership of this podcast we all enjoy doing or listening to.
Very selfless act that you made.
Thank you. Yeah, that thing, yes.
If you missed out, listeners, then you should be on Twitter and following us on social media because that's where this was organized.
We'll do another one.
But be on social media or else you'll miss it again.
That's right. We don't know. Like, we can't say now because it won't work. So you don't know when you are in time. You're somewhere lost in time, dear listener. Somewhere.
Yeah.
Floating in the inky blackness of space-time.
In the prognostus? Phostogen? The phostogen of time?
No. You don't want to be the phostogen. That would be, oh, God, I'm on fire. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Ether.
Okay. And
somewhere
anyway,
in the ether.
You told us a story about being an idiot teenager with your idiot teenager friends and firing an arrow directly up.
Yes.
And then realizing it was going to come down.
Yes.
You said that firing an arrow is straight up, and you should have said loosing and not firing, because as you have had to walk twice before, arrows are not firearms. Bow and arrows are not firearms. They are loosed, not fired.
I'm going to say that English changes with time and context.
Well, it hasn't changed in the direction that you want it to, so it's still loosing and not firing an arrow.
Damn it.
At any rate, you said that it would result in the arrow returning at the same speed that it left.
Same energy, yes.
At the time, I said your position might be correct on the moon, but there would be drag on Earth because of the feathers, and you said that that would be negligible.
Yes.
I then reiterated my position to a more whimsical position that the feathers would make it stay up longer because feathers are anti-gravity and that's how birds fly.
Right. And I'm the one getting the walk of shame.
Yeah. Al Batson had emailed me before the party had finished, pointing out that, like everything with a surface area, arrows have a terminal velocity. Yes. Terminal velocity is constant regardless from how high it fell from. If the arrow is fired at twice terminal velocity, it will still only be traveling at terminal velocity when it returns to Earth.
Right.
It is, however, very hard to calculate the terminal velocity of an arrow. Drag coefficients are very, very complex math. Also, it depends on the weight of the arrow and the resistance on it, and there was no one on the internet who wanted to work that out. So I searched for an hour. Okay. What we do know is that the drag is a force that acts on an arrow. If we fired an arrow with no feathers from a solid location, but in an environment with no gravity no air.
Sorry, Dan, can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Dan, can I stop you there?
Yeah.
You made a little mistake there.
Yeah.
You have to loose an arrow. You don't fire an arrow. You loose an arrow.
Oh, sorry, I'm going to edit that out. I don't want to. No.
Go on, please.
Damn it. If we loosed an arrow with no feathers from a solid location, but in an environment with no gravity and no air, actually, thank God you picked that up, because next episode I know that one of our listeners would have written in.
Damn it!
If we fire an arrow, loosing an arrow with no feathers from a solid location, but in an environment with no gravity and no air, we would expect that arrow to shoot forward and start to tumble. Now, you might ask, how do you get a solid location that doesn't have gravity?
Yes.
Okay. Let's say we don't have a solid location. Instead, we have two arches floating in space. They are tied together back to back and shoot identical arrows in opposite directions.
Okay, good. Right.
Okay, yeah, sure. So they're going to stay still.
Yes.
That arrow, or stick, since it has no feathers, would be going fast.
Mm-hmm.
About 100 meters per second from a top of the line compound bow.
Right.
The only force acting on it is the gravitational pull from the arches.
Mm-hmm.
If we shot the same arrow and put feathers on it, it would tumble in exactly the same way. The feathers or fletchings are there to resist the air, and they pull the back of the arrow. With no air, there's no force on the fletchings.
Can I just ask a question? When you say tumble, do you mean end over end?
It depends on the
tumble, like, in my. You mean spin, don't you mean? Like, as in it rotates around its long axis, not it's tumbling end over end.
It wouldn't tumble. It would tumble end over end. Because
arrows tumble end over end.
Yes, it would have to if there was no air. Because the energy that. Because in order for it to go exactly straight, you would have to put force into the arrow that was exactly lined up with it. And anything that was
the
off.
Vector. Yeah. Yes. The vector would be, I see what you're saying. Yeah, okay, got it. Yeah. Because you can't keep it directly down the direction of motion. Yeah, okay, cool.
Now,
makes sense.
If we added air resistance to the story, the arrow would fly straight because the back of the arrow is being gently pulled backwards by the resistance on the fletchings. But we know that force wasn't there when there was no air medium, so this arrow has to be going slower than the other two launches.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Now, I couldn't find the terminal velocity of a falling arrow, but I did find something that was quite similar.
Mm-hmm.
The Peregrine Falcon.
Right.
Why the Falcon? Yeah. It's supposed to fly very quickly. It's supposed to go straight down. It's aerodynamic and points in the same direction the whole time. It is also fairly light. Now, a Peregrine Falcon can dive at 386 kilometers per hour.
Wow.
The fastest arrow launch from a compound bow is estimated at 360 kilometers per hour. So if you were above a diving falcon and you were trying to shoot it, your arrow's launch speed would be slower than the falcon's top speed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, you being a dumb kid, I doubt that you would have had a state-of-the-art compound bow.
No.
So everything I could find seems to support your claim that the arrow would land at the same speed that it was launched at.
Excellent.
There is actually a claim that it could arrive slightly faster.
Right.
Any idea why?
Caught by a Peregrine Falcon and dragged to my location.
That is certainly an idea.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's certainly a thought that you had.
Your sentence was really nice, and then full stop, and you just stopped then, and we'd be much happier.
Got more passive-aggressive, didn't it? Okay. Number one, the arrow is launched above the ground. On its return, it would be traveling the same launch speed at the height that it's launched, but it would still be accelerating for the additional meter towards the ground.
Yes, yeah, yes, exactly right. Yes, that's because it would still be accelerating up to the telemetry velocity. Yes.
Now, number two,
but that couldn't be from my location then. So it couldn't. So the arrow couldn't return to my location if my location was off the ground. Then it would land in me if it hit me in the head. It would land in the location I fired it from, which have to be the same location, not 1 meter lower.
Yes.
Unless I'm in a balloon that's descending.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not my location then.
That's true.
And frame of reference is the balloon. Then we can say the balloon is the frame of reference. Therefore, it is the location I fired it from. It's a relativity. Not relativity in that way. No. Anyway.
All right. So number two is the Archer's paradox and what you mean by the term launch speed.
Uh-huh.
So on a longbow, the arrow sits on the side of the bow. You release, the string pulls forward on the bow, and the energy goes straight towards the bow. The arrow presses into the bow because it's slightly at the side of it. Mm. So it actually scrapes along the side of the bow.
Mm.
And that energy gets pushed into it, and then it flexes away from it. And then it oversteers, and then it wobbles back. And as it's going past the bow, the flex just misses the bow.
Yeah. So for our podcast, what it basically sounds like is wobble, 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 wobble. You see a slow motion. Wobble, 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 wobble.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you know exactly what I mean, listeners, when I say wobble, 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 wobble. But super high speed. That's like a slowed down, slow motion, slow mo guys on YouTube kind of sound effect.
Usually you would expect the arrow to sort of slide off the side of the bow and go off in that direction. But it doesn't because the energy is in one direction and the arrow continues going along in that direction. It doesn't fly off to the side.
The energy's in one direction, but they're both in sync?
Yeah. I get it. I get it. It's a boy band joke, right?
I like it that way. Backspeed's back, baby.
So imagine if that wobble was really pronounced. And so the arrow is stationary, but it's wobbling really hard. So the center of the arrow goes from the left to the right, to the left to the right. The back and the front of the arrow keep pulling in towards the center area and then springing out when the arrow is in mid-wobble.
Mm-hmm.
And at side wobble, they come back. So the front of the arrow is going backwards in relation to the whole arrow sometimes. Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
This means that the arrow is very slightly pulled backwards and then forwards, then backwards again, then forwards, then backwards, and eventually matches the speed of the back of the arrow. At some point before the arrow leaves the string, the back of the arrow hits its top speed. For the tiniest fraction of a second, the drag amount starts to reduce the speed of the arrow more than the string is imbuing it with energy. So the fastest the arrow is going is slightly before it leaves the string. The arrow leaves the string. This is the official launch point of the arrow. So this is the launch moment. But the arrow may be in full flex position, so full bent position, and the arrowhead may speed up fractionally after leaving the string.
Right.
But the rest of the arrow doesn't. Like the back half of the arrow doesn't.
Right.
But the arrow is knocked, which means that just prior to the launch point, the arrow is actually pulling the string with it, putting a little bit of energy into the string until the arrow unknocks, plucking free of the string, which pulls a little tiny bit of forward energy out of the arrow.
Mm-hmm.
If this energy is larger than the wobble energy of the arrow, then this might pull the arrow back into shape at the launch point, making this whole thing mute.
Moot.
Mute.
Not mute.
Yeah.
It'll still go wagga 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 wagga.
Yes. There is another way the arrow could gain speed after launch. If it was launched at 100 meters per second upwards and there was a crosswind that picked up just after launch, it would carry the arrow sideways and the resulting speed would be 141 meters per second. But then the arrow wouldn't be going up and down.
Yeah. I love vectors. Adding vectors is great. Side vectors and like in one X and Y vectors. It's part of physics I enjoy the most because when you break down complex motions into two vectors or three vectors, and it all makes sense at that point. And you go, oh, I know where this is going to land. Oh, love it, love it. Real world is never that nice, though.
Yeah. So the only way that you could exceed the terminal velocity of the arrow and create the situation that Al wanted to pull you up on is if you had a hitherto undiscovered way of launching arrows. Maybe if you put it into like some sort of particle accelerator type thing or a rail gun?
Yes, yeah, that would make sense. A peregrine accelerator, basically just a big tube with like six peregrine falcons attached to the end.
That's and a they good grab idea.
It, and they fire it and they grab it and they fly away with it.
Now, the point of your story was, can a falling arrow still do damage? Yes, very much so.
Yes.
There was a recent episode of Mythbusters that proved just that experimentally. And a recent episode of Mythbusters.
That's with the same guys, are they gone now?
Not the same, they're gone. Oh, okay. They've been replaced. Okay. They've been given the ass.
Sexy new Mythbusters.
Sexy new Mythbusters.
Okay.
And their moustaches are not nearly as impressive. So, any walk of shame for me?
Oh, sorry.
Probably not.
Dan. The biggest mistake we ever do on this podcast is to go into great detail about sciences that we're not experts in.
I thought the biggest mistake was saying fire, not loose an arrow.
Well, that's one of our many mistakes.
Yep.
Dan, you bravely, bravely walked into the world of biology, which is a horrible world.
Well, that's where I excel.
Yeah, well, and you started talking about chromosomes, Dan. You made a whole thing about chromosomal stuff.
Yeah.
And good Lord, people come out of the woodwork to have a chat to you about that one.
Oh, good.
So Michael Barnes. Hi, Michael. We love you, Michael. Michael Barnes. So a possible walk of shame for Dan. And I say possible due to one caveat he included. At 45:07 of the episode, ladies don't have any Y at all. And then 45:21, Y is always male. At 45:41, I love the fact he timestamps everything, they'd be a male. So that's how they define it. Michael asks, who are they? This is where the caveat comes in that I'm not sure who they are. Is there a recognized international body of genetics whose speciality is sex chromosomes? Is there no sex genetic equivalent to the International Astronomy Union? I offer basically saying this. You said they define it.
I see.
But that's just him. That's just a bit of fun. That's just a bit of fun. All right. That's just him. He's just pulling your leg there. That's not really a walk of shame.
Okay.
That's just a bit of fun. That was a bit of fun. Now
I thought fun was generally more fun.
He's just wondering. He's saying maybe they just mean, you know, look, fine. But
I don't know. Science, Wikipedia. I know
the Illuminati.
That's the ones?
Yeah.
The ones who help at illuminating people.
Yes. Like the moon, keeping werewolves on track. XY gonadal dysgenesis, also known as sewer syndrome, is a type of hypogonadism in a person with karyotype type 46XY. 46XY. They have normal female external genitalia, identify as female, and are raised as girls. So they have a Y chromosome.
Yeah.
They have, inverted commas, normal female external genitalia, identify as female, and are raised as girls. You said having Y always means you registered as male. Not true. Absolutely not. This is due to a mutation of SRY genes on the 46Y chromosome account for many cases of sewer syndrome. So it's a whole syndrome that means that someone who identifies as female, raised as female, and has a chromosomal Y chromosome is still externally female and identifies as female.
Yeah, but okay, this is a very complex topic, but whether someone identifies as female or not is unhelpful when you are discussing chromosomes. Now,
but that person is not in the definition as what he's trying to get at is, you said that if you have a Y, you're going to identify as a male. You're going to be a male. And he's saying, no, in this case, this person has a Y chromosome. And in every other way, except if you look chromosomally, they are female.
There is actually a whole other range of things that change how people develop, which is something I'd sort of earmarked to maybe look into in the future.
He has. So when I said that we all start as female, he says, what I think you were alluding to, Greg, is the basic design of all humans is female, even if they have a Y chromosome. unless the testis determining factor, the TDF, also known as the sex determining region, the SRY protein, is expressed, then the body remains female.
Yeah.
So if you have this, if you have a Y chromosome that doesn't express, then you remain female in every other. You can have the chromosome inside you,
yeah,
and every other part of your physical sex is female.
This is true. This is true. So there's a whole other step between chromosomes and who and gender. There's a chunk in between there.
Oh, look. Oh, not even gender. Let's just talk about sex at this point. Don't go gender. Don't. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I think there's a bigger jump of what you just said then.
No.
This is talking about expressing sex and if you can have a Y chromosome and not express it, and therefore your sex is female. Your biological sex is female, even though you had a Y chromosome. Yes.
But you're still, but you'd still be male because you had the Y chromosome. But except the Y chromosome didn't express. Right. Yeah, it's a super complicated field.
It is.
And
it is.
I see what he's getting at. I'm not going to walk though because I didn't get anything wrong.
You did.
No,
you
I
said
didn't.
That people with Y are always male, and that's not true.
But he is male because he's got Y.
No.
That's all.
No.
Didn't you ask them? They.
No, that's the thing. It's the expressing. It's not having the Y chromosome that defines your sex as male or female. It's the expression of a chromosome that defines you as male or female.
It but didn't not express. Chromosomally.
It is.
All right. It is. Fine.
But sex isn't chromosomal. So you're
send me the notes. I'm doing another segment.
You're walking. And the other one from Alan. I have discovered a walk of shame for Dan. Despite his copious research into sex and gender in pursuit of hypermasculinity, he stumbled over a basic foundation block of the whole discussion.
I do not like that phrase.
At 3609 in episode 161, Dan said that the female egg or ovum has two X chromosomes, but one is deactivated. He is incorrect.
Ah, okay.
The vast majority of human cells have 46 chromosomes, typically. Dividing into two cells, they go through a process of mitosis.
Mm-hmm.
This produces two copies of the cell, both with 46 chromosomes, typically. When gametes are formed, being male sperm and female ova, the cells go through a process called meiosis. This produces cells with only 23 chromosomes each, typically.
Ah.
The ovum has 23 chromosomes and only one X chromosome, typically. When the 23 chromosome ovum and 23 chromosome sperm join during fertilization, the result is a 46 chromosome cell, typically, which goes on to form a human, typically. Apologies for all the typically, but considering all the variations over a range of sex chromosome combinations, I thought it appropriate. Here is a primer for Dan to get it right next time. And then there's a link to meiosis, which I will send to you.
Yeah.
And we'll put a link in.
Okay. Very nice. Oh, that's okay. That makes a lot more sense. Thank you very much. Yep. Who was that?
That was Alan.
Alan, thank you.
Yes, very good. So that was when I read that one. Like, yeah, that's pretty basic. I see a mistake there. So that's pretty cool. It's hard. Biology's awful. And normally I'm like, yeah, take it, Dan. Take the walks of shame. But biology sucks. I'm a physics guy. Biology is messy and stupid and subjective, where physics is pure and beautiful and objective and lovely. I will fight you on that.
Say that now, but I spent friggin' 3 hours trying to work out how arrows worked. The amount of friggin' nonsense to figure out how fast an arrow was going. And that's pure physics.
It's gonna be some sort of terrible chemistry or biology rubbish. But you got an answer at the end. That's the thing. Anyway, but look, thank you to our listeners. When we do make mistakes, which we sometimes do, when we put those mistakes in just a little traps, so someone steals the information from our podcast, like the map makers of old, we'll know they stole it because they put the same mistake in, and we'll go, "Aha! You put that mistake in your podcast. You now owe us $1 million." Then you can help us out by pointing out where we had them. So please, by sending them, if I make a mistake, Gregoire, please send them to dan@smartenough.org. I'm doing this wrong now.
Not only are you doing it wrong, but I've still got another one to give you.
Oh, no.
In episode 161, just before the 1 hour mark, Greg asserted that Star Trek aliens shouldn't be able to cross species, that it's a stupid story point.
Yes,
Scott Driscoll says he is so wrong it hurts.
No, well, he's wrong.
And he pointed me in the direction of the relevant episode. In the Star Trek Next Generation, Season 6, Episode 20, Professor Xavier and a Klingon and a Romulan find a planet that has a message encoded in the lichen DNA that explains that all humanoid-based life in the Alpha Quadrant was seeded by a progenitor race. They all share DNA. Yes. What this means is that it makes sense that they all kind of look the same. Also, that perhaps it's not impossible for them to have hybrid babies together, but it has been long enough for them to become their own species. We know that Dr. Spock is half human and half Vulcan.
Yeah, sure. And in the latest one, in Picard, there's a half-human, half-Romulan.
They
have a baby. So, yeah, there's a – well, she's a baby. And anyway, there's a pregnant woman, a pregnant Romulan woman with a human father baby.
Ah.
Look, Scott, fine. I think – I'm not going to go check this, but I'm gonna boldly state it, boldly go where only Scott Driscoll has been before.
Mm-hmm.
And say I wasn't talking about the Star Trek universe. I was talking about the universe in general, that mating with other races would be impossible. Wasn't I not mentioning the real universe, not the Star Trek universe?
You were saying in Star Trek how they're always having sex and having babies, and which is ridiculous.
Oh, God. Well, if I said that – I don't like the way you put it, but the tone, but it's fine. look, fine.
Hey, sorry if I'm just the most amazing mimic in the world.
You suck. No, he's right. And as soon as you started saying it, I remember that, in fact, there was a progenitor species in Star Trek. That's why they look like humans with crabs on their heads.
Yeah.
Klingon. Yes. Fine. I will walk it. I won't even. Thank you, Scott.
When I call him Dr. Spock, I know he's not a real doctor, but he does like to play the drums. Now, wolves, coyotes, jackals, dingoes, and domestic dogs can all interbreed and have babies that have babies.
Interesting.
But a fox-wolf hybrid shouldn't work. Like, foxes have a different number of chromosomes. Similarly, big cats and horses tend not to have fertile offspring.
Big cat and horses?
Not together, but...
Oh, my God!
As in tigers and ligers and horses and donkeys.
That would be a horrible... Mummy, that lion's attacking that horse. It's going to... Don't look away, darling. Look away. Rawr, 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 rawr.
Listeners, if you could see the video I'm seeing. they have mismatched amounts of chromosomes. Occasionally, you can mate a female, say a liger, back in with one of its original species. But there is no record of fertile male mules, hinnies, ligers, or tigons.
There have been fertile mules, though.
Well, what happens is
they definitely have been fertile.
So I think the hinny is the male pairing, and the mule is the female pairing.
As in a male, a mule is a male donkey and a female horse, and a hinny is a male horse and a female donkey.
Yes. Yes, and so ligers and tigons are the same thing. Now, mules can't mate with other mules, but on average,
but there have been, and walk of shame if you like, and I'm remembering this from somewhere weird, you are right, it shouldn't be, but I think there have been mules that have had mule children. It shouldn't happen, it can happen.
Well, maybe you're right, but I couldn't find that, but what you can do is mate a mule back with a horse. Or a donkey.
Okay. Right.
Presumably for the same reason that we were discussing why YY wouldn't work, because they're the mods. And so if the animal that they're mating back with has all of the information, then whatever you're adding the mule information back to has all the stuff that's needed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Interesting. I just quickly looked on the internet. There's mules and ligers. I'm just doing a quick research, which is weird for us. But why I'm pointing this out is, yes, mules, ligers, tigons, cool. There's something called a zedonk.
Yes, zedonks.
And a leopon, a leopard, and some sort of apron. a lion and a leopard. There you go. And it's amazing. I want one in my house. A beefalo. Oh, my God. I just found a whole list of a pumapod. Oh, my God, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah.
A pizzly. Sorry. Zorse.
Yeah. Well, look, the way that they get these animals can be quite cruel. So just keep that in mind if you're going to buy a ligon.
A hoolfin! Oh, a whale dolphin.
It's a part way between a human and a dolphin.
It's a hoolfin. Oh, I like it's a werewolf and a dolphin. Michael Collins went for a swim.
Anyway. This has been the Walk of Shame.
I don't know how it works. Explain it.
If Greg makes a mistake, then send an email to dan@smartenough.org. If Dan makes a mistake, send an email to greg@smartenough.org. You have been listening to dan@smartenough.org.
Also greg@smartenough.org.
You can click all of the buttons on our website at smartenough.org, including subscribing to the podcast and following us on social media.
And you can do things like buy shirts. And why I'm mentioning it is not to make you buy more shirts, but people have been buying shirts. Like, quite a few people have been buying shirts.
You can check out the website, and the show notes will have links to various stuff that we've chatted on about.
Yes.
It's a great place to start proving us wrong.
And
good
jumping
off point.
Yes. And it's fun to read them, too.
If you would like to support the podcast, please do share it with people. People are bored because they're at home and they're listening to more and more podcasts. So make sure they know about Smart Enough Know Better, our podcast of science, comedy, and ignorance.
And thank you once again to the people who do that. We did a call out last time, and this time I've noticed even more people I don't recognize, which sometimes your friends do it for you or people you've met, but two other people, and I'm sorry, I'm a bad host and I haven't written down your names, but two people I don't know who you are started promoting it to random scientists and people around the world. I was like, oh wow, so thank you for that. It's seriously the best thing you can do, is put us on other people's radars.
Yeah, because what's the point otherwise? We'd like to be listened to.
I'm not going to do it myself. I'm not going to, you should listen to my podcast.
Oh, I do all the time. I'm selfish. It's disgusting.
Good man.
If you would like to support us financially, you could drop a tip into our tip jar on the website, or you can become a patron. The lowest tier is $2 a month. The next tier is $5 a month, where we will read your name out on the podcast, and I'm about to do that. Thank you very much.
I just want to say I'm going to do a call out for my dad, because my dad obviously decided I need money, and so he just put in like dollars, quite a few dollars.
$50.
$50. So yeah. Thank you, Dad. That's very kind. You don't need to do that. That's very kind. Not anyone else. That wasn't.
And the best bit is that I'm in charge of the PayPal account, and Greg hasn't seen a dime of that yet.
So it's very kind. You don't need to. Thank you, my dad, for giving me $50, but not giving Dan $50,
or at least $48, and PayPal $1.60. So that's
true. So Elon Musk can continue sending people into space.
Yay! So, a big thank you to Morden O'Hare, Andrew Whitehurst, A.V. Greenbury, Matthew Toy, Michael Barnes, Steve E., Andrew Trousdale, Lindsay Jenkinson, Elizabeth Yunkin, Andrew Potts, Phil Holland, Gary Heather, Grain Maguire, new name.
Oh, excellent. Hello.
Matt Ewers and Elena Mitchell.
Thank you very much
for supporting the podcast.
It's very good, yes.
Now, there's a top tier where you pay $15 a month, US, and...
Yes, that's US.
You get to be insulted by me.
Mm, mm.
Thanks for setting that up, Greg.
No, it's fine. It's good. It's so weird that people do this.
Yeah.
It was a weird one-off comment, and it's been one of the most successful things on our podcast financially. It's insane.
It also takes the longest time to do.
Dan's really earning that money, everyone.
Okay, so... This podcast is coming out towards the end of April.
Good.
That means we're very, very close to the 1st of May. The 1st of May.
Uh-oh.
Outdoor f***ing starts today.
I knew that Jonathan Colton would come. I knew it. Oh my God.
That's not going to happen this year. Everyone's got to stay inside.
Yep.
F*** inside, everyone. Don't f*** outside.
You're just making this very hard to edit for yourself, you realize.
Yeah. Oh, look, the whole thing's hard for me to edit at this point, Greg. I've been recording for 2 hours now.
Thank God you got nothing else to do. You sit at home and edit this podcast. You're welcome, Dan. You're welcome.
My factory needs to grow. Okay, so this one involves naked body part insults.
Oh, no!
Which, you know what? I feel like this one's going to be a bit easier than usual.
Hang on, wait. Have you been getting onto their partners and asking for naked photos when they were sleeping or something? Because, I'm kind of cool with that.
I haven't, but partners of people in the podcast. I mean, obviously, if the partner is listening to the podcast, then your partner is also listening to the podcast. Yes. So you're a pair of people listening to the podcast. So you've got a sort of a mutually assured destruction thing about to happen.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not. Please don't take photos of your partners and send them to us. It seems very illegal and unethical.
Yeah, yeah. No, that would probably be illegal for me for us to request that.
Yeah,
and illegal for you to do that. But yes. We're not going to call you out if it happens.
No,
like,
no.
If that happens, I'm not going to do some sort of expensive investigation.
Is this the equivalent of the podcast wink? Wink, wink. It's not winking at the Dan. It's, no, 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 Dan.
Send nudes.
No, Dan. And I will tell the Frog Princess.
Okay.
I'll be happy with you.
Sure,
and she'll beat you up. We had this conversation before the podcast started. She'll kick your ass like Tom Holland.
She is really getting fit. Scarily so. Okay, so naked body part insults for our top patron.
God. Oh, okay. No. Oh, no.
Scott Driscoll. Ass.
Good.
Quite
good.
Simple. Yeah, easy, good. To the point.
Start small. Very good. Yep.
Michael Keaton and Dustin Fallon. They're a couple of boobs.
Nice.
Okay. Steve good. Stewart. He's the pits.
Good. Nice. I like this. This is yep. Going well. It's going well.
And good. Finally, Tom Seary, twat. I mean, it's mispronounced, but...
Yes. Yeah, yeah, sure.
It works better written down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. And for our auditory podcast, well done.
And also, thank you very much to Eric Wilson and Al Batson, who say I don't have to insult them. They're my favourite two stand-up members.
Yes.
So, it is... So, we're beginning in May is coming up. It's my birthday on May the 3rd.
Aw, happy birthday, Dan.
For my birthday, if you want to make me happy, send me a picture of you dressed up as a video game character for me to try and guess who you are. The crapper the costume, the better.
No, that sounds like fun. Everyone do that. Yeah, do that thing for Dan. Cool. You've got 2 weeks, basically, or a week and a half when this comes out.
And as we... Well, what are they going to do? Go out to a costume shop? Can't imagine that that's a... essential service.
I have many. I don't know if anyone's following me on the Twitter.
On the grams?
On the grams, but I every Friday I put on an exciting costume. It's great.
Do you wear that all day?
I wear it to all my meetings, yes.
Nice.
What's fun about that? My actual serious job, yes, I do wear them for my meetings, Zoom meetings. But what's really cool is I've been there long enough now, everyone's like, yep, that's what he does. It's not like, oh my God. It was like, oh, Greg's in a thing. Mm-hmm. And there's that level of, even there are younger people. What I love is, it's fine. There are people who are older than me and like serious professors. And they're all like, well, you're very clever. that disapproving voice that your parents give you. Like, you're following your own drum. Well, well done. You can hear what they're really saying is no. But now I got the same from one of the PhD students, like a man in his early 20s who gave me the same kind of, yes, you're very funny. I was like, yes!
You just imagine him talking to someone else. Going, does he have tenure or something? How is he still here?
How is he still? What is going on? He must have dirt on someone. Because anyway, yes. So you can check me out on the grams, Gregoire on the grams. I don't know. What am I?
Why don't I just link to it in the show notes?
Gregoire23. There you go. Gregoire23. But you'll know because you'll find me, you'll see a picture of me, and you'll say, I'm a co-host of Smart Enough to Know Better, a podcast of science, comedy, and ignorance. See, I even promote us on the grams, Dan. Look at that.
And as we always like to say...
Wash your damn hands! I know I said that last time, but just wash them.
Buy guns. Send notes.
Don't send nudes, please. Oh God, please don't.
Unless it's a video game character who's known for being nude, in which case that's going to be a good one.
Was it no? What's her name? Barbarella? No, not Barbarella. Bayonetta. There you go. Scott Driscoll dressed up as Bayonetta.
Are there any nude video game characters?
Yeah, Bayonetta. She's
Custer. Custer's Revenge.
Leisure Suit Larry.
You never see him. Oh, yeah, he is nude in some. In, like, the end of number two, I think.
Oh, there you go. You've really checked.
It's all censored, usually.
In Sims, you can get a patch, I've heard.
Ah, right,
and
yes.
You go naked and like that and watch them poo.
That's what you want to do.
That's what people do with their lives, supposedly. No, nudity is bad. It's okay to gun people down with an AK-47, AK-23 in your case, and take people apart and that sort of stuff on a molecular level, but having sex with them or seeing them naked will destroy the fabric of society.
They don't need fabric. They're nude. Is Bayonetta nude? She's wearing clothes in this.
No. That's her hair.
Maybe I've got safe search on or something. Oh, I know. I'll do it from Bing.
Watch a video of her using her powers.
Well, in that case, if it's hair, then Scott Driscoll's going to have problems.
Indeed. Love you, Scott.
I'm having trouble taking deep breaths today, and I think it's because I've inhaled my body weight in fumes because I oiled the back deck.
Nice.
But at the same time, it might be because I've been doing push-ups and the muscles here are just like, nah, we're not going to work anymore, and they're important.
It's not COVID? I haven't got the COVID?
I can still smell. Oh, God, can I smell?
Medicine is useless.
Yeah,
that's what I'm going to say. Doctors, pointless. Like, yeah. they're just like, we think this.
Yeah.
Any evidence? No evidence. I'm like, no. I had a guy say a story in a room, and now we're just telling everyone that's the actual rule. And you're like,
we've been mocking those homeopaths for a decade now, and yeah. It turns out they're just as worthwhile to listen to than actual medical professionals.
I think everyone's got a spin of everything. Everything's subjective, Dan. Everything's subjective. But it's...
you say that.
That's your take on it. They just turn around and walk backwards into each other, like two faces facing the opposite direction. Now we can annoy twice as many people. Jack Christ.
They're a real pain in the janus.
Very good.
Isn't that great?
That's pretty good.
Oh, I'm ready. And suddenly you've got so much money, you're like, oh, I can do whatever I want with my money. And then you start, and then you buy a boat. And apparently buying a boat is the purchase that is the most regretted.
Yes. Anecdotally, I can back that up. Not for me, but every person I know who's bought a boat has normally sold it going, Jesus Christ, it's so expensive. And normally it's like one person in the family, normally the dad, who's like, why are people using my very expensive boat? And the family's like, we don't want to go on your stupid bloody boat. We want to sit in our iPads. And you know, talk to our boyfriends, et cetera, et cetera.
I've got a kayak. I've only taken it out 8 times in the last 2 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I assume it's just so you can escape from the apocalypse. That's just so you can paddle into the...
Well, the reason is, in order to take it down to where I can launch it, I have to, like, lift it on top of the car, and it's real heavy. Hurts my muscles.
Aw, get the Frog Princess into it.
Yeah, admittedly, she's a lot stronger than me these days. You should see the girl doing the... She's standing in front of the TV doing the workout videos and stuff. She's moved on from yoga and Pilates, and now she's, like, lifting weights while she does handstands and stuff. And, like, one-handed handstands while lifting weights in the air and stuff. And
what, is she
screaming.
Tom Holland?
Yeah, I know.
Hell, she's Spider-Man. That's insane. Oh. I don't like it. Tell her I don't like it.
Yeah, she's going to be doing backflips soon, doing that thing where she runs up the wall and does a flip. So we're up to the Walk of Shame already.
We are.
And I say already, we've been recording for an hour and 25 minutes.